You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's podcast is with Russ Newman, who's a specialist in new media and digital education at New York University. He was the John Derby Evans Professor of Media Technology and Communication Studies and Research Professor at the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan, and also taught at the University of Pennsylvania, where he directed the Information and Society Program at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. He's written a bunch of books, and his new one is called Evolutionary Intelligence: How Technology Will Make Us Smarter. Love the conversation. I think you will too. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another letter left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Russ Newman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So a couple of weeks ago, my wife Anne was leading a workshop at a CARE conference at UCLA in Los Angeles, and was put on by her friends at Caring Across Generations. So she was teaching a class around improv skills for caregivers. But the thing that blew her away was a piece of technology she was given, because she had two Spanish speakers in the group. So Anne would speak into this microphone on her lapel that would instantaneously translate English to Spanish into headphones of these two participants. And you write about this kind of technology in your book, and I don't know, but the fact that we have a technology that can answer the origin myth of the Tower of Babel is absolutely mind-blowing to me. Why is that everyone talking about this?
You know, every time I get to work on a paper or a book, I want to put that wonderful image of the Tower of Babel, the biblical image, that everyone's saying, oh my gosh, I can't speak to my neighbors because we all... God had smote us and gave us different languages. We no longer recognize each other's tongue.
And now you're like, God, we have an app for that.
That there's
right. That's essentially
a warning to our listeners. The biblical message was, beware of hubris. God got upset and said, you think you can climb to the heavens with that tower of yours? Mm-hmm. Be not so proud. And, so I think the issue of, we all use the term hype to characterize when a new technology demonstrates some particular strengths. We go, oh my gosh. So there will be a hype cycle. We're probably at the peak of the hype cycle this year. And then there'll be some dramatic failures from which we will learn. But I think modesty and avoiding the kind of hubris that, well, now we've got the answer to everything. That said, my role in the public discussion about AI and its use is I'm in the minority. As so many of my colleagues have said, beware, Siri wants to kill you. And I keep saying, I'm not so sure she does.
Well, and I think I think where you ground the book makes sense with regard to, you know, humans are storytelling machines. We love our stories, and we don't always. We're certainly not always conscious of what those stories have been telling us. You and I are both of a certain age where we probably saw 2001: A Space Odyssey in the theater. I did, and so HAL was killing us before Siri was killing us. And you even talk about the Terminator, and like so. We both grew up in places where science fiction was constantly giving us this warning that the computers, the robots, they're going to take over. But what you offer in the book is that actually this if we see this as a collaboration, then this is an incredible addition to our ability, especially in the various areas of biases that all human beings walk around with. And if we can get help with that, I would think we'd want the help.
Kelly, you're a storyteller. You're a student of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And many of us professionally, and I just wanted to back up a little bit and say, well, why is it that humans are so resonant with the notion of a story? And I think the answer is, if you think about the 400,000 years that basically modern humans have been roaming around the globe, we've only had partial speech. It was mostly grunts and gestures and partial language and certainly no written language. So how do you remember stuff? Well, you tell epic stories one thing happens after another. And that's sort of how it makes it possible for the human brain to organize and make sense of a very complicated and confusing world. So, and there's a moral to the tale often that helps us make judgments in the future. So if you think about it, that's why when we project onto these robots that want to kill us, that's an anthropomorphic projection, because we grew up in the jungles and grasslands fighting for scarce resources against other humans and probably other animals. And computers didn't grow up that way. No. You made the reference to Hal. And when they finally unplugged much of Hal, he was singing some nursery rhymes and a wonderful section in the movie. And the computers didn't compete with each other for scarce electrons. I think we can take advantage of the fact that we have the capacity now with these computers doing very complicated logical processes to program them to complement the human biases and prejudices and prejudgments and confirmation biases. So that's why I say this is a case where earlier technologies made us stronger and telecommunications let us communicate over long distances. Mm-hmm. There's a real chance for these technologies to make us smarter.
And you're right. This is the way I know this is dominating the narrative is basically all the podcasts I listen to, they keep talking about AI. We just went through this strike, which in large part SAG-AFTRA, which was talking about AI. And just about an hour before we started taping this podcast, Harvard Business Review, the publicists that sent me the books coming up, and it is one AI book after another. And you've been in this world for a while, which is why I appreciate all the different angles you talk about. And one of the things I had a question about, it comes up early in your book, and I wrote down the quote you say in the book, quote, "The Turing test has dominated thinking about machine intelligence for three generations. I will argue that this highly intuitive model is actually misleading and wrongheaded." Many people know Alan Turing from the film where Benedict Cumberbatch played him. But tell us a little bit about why the Turing test is not the thing that maybe we thought it was.
The Turing test is basically a very informal, casually put forward notion by Turing before we really invented computers. He had come up with some abstract concepts that turned out to be very influential, the ultimate architecture. This is the 1930s and 40s and then the early 50s. He said, if you're communicating with an unknown object, this, the notion would be on a keyboard typing, and the unknown person or machine on the other side of the curtain was responding in such a way as you couldn't be sure whether the person or the machine you're talking to is a human or a machine. Mm-hmm. That's when we've reached this so-called AGI, artificial general intelligence, human level intelligence. So the Turing test is, well, now if we're going to invent stuff, let's see if they can be as smart as humans. And the reason I reject that is, why would we want to base the model on all of the flawed and evolved problems we've got? Here's a chance for us to basically recognize, let's go back to that hubris issue, recognize the limitations of our cognitive capacities and come up with something even better.
Yeah, we're a lemon, I guess is what you're saying. You're looking like this is like, don't do that. It's interesting too, because so when businesses bring Second City in to work with them, a lot of that is because The skill building that happens here is making individuals aware that they are fallible creatures and that we're going to fail over and over and over again. In fact, it's often funny. And this idea of being the ability to make something out of nothing with someone else requires you to navigate all through that kind of ambiguity and take whatever's in front of you and play with it. And mistakes are okay and all that stuff. And I think one thing that we're saying is probably true of humans and technology is, of course, they're error prone. And I think what we're seeing with this particular kind of technology, which I think is different, and you can explain this to us, is that it can learn now in a way that maybe wasn't available to other forms of earlier technology. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. So how do they get to do that? how does that happen?
Well, the fundamental brilliance of Alan Turing and Neumann and the early designers of computers was to have an if statement. So the computer basically says, well, if this is true, I'm going to go in this direction. And if this is false, I'm going to go in another direction. And if you pile those if statements up in a complex way using something they call Boolean logic, you can really generate a sophisticated decision process. And the term artificial intelligence was invented in the mid-1950s, where a bunch of scientists got together up on the Dartmouth campus in the summer of 1955 and said, well, what could we possibly do now that we've got a computer? And the computer was barely 10 years old then. And they had an image of this thing that would be separate from and competing with humans and could be as smart as humans. And they went through 60 years of failure after failure, or partial success, or there would be funding that was withdrawn because they said, oh, you're barking up the wrong tree. This isn't working. We need something else. And so the question that gets asked is, well, what was missing and how come we've got all the excitement now? And the answer is there were three things that were missing. The first was strong enough computational capacity. Mm-hmm. Our engineering friends call it compute. I got to have a lot of compute. I don't know why. That really strikes me as money. I want more compute. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is hundreds of millions of dollars and many gigawatts of electrical power to get all this compute. The second thing they didn't have was a large data source from which to process this. And of course, the internet has taken much of the world, digitized it, and made it accessible to these large language models and these visual models. And the third thing is they didn't have the math to deal with the millions of parameters that were in. There was a very famous article called, cutely, Attention is All You Need, that had some simplifying mathematics so that they could go through gigantic amounts of data and come up with parameters to help the decision process. Literally, thousands and thousands of sequential if statements. And so it turns out that the GPT 3, 3.5, and 4 have in the neighborhood of 200 billion parameters. And they're done in layers. That's why they call it a neural net. And that corresponds roughly to the 90 billion neurons in the human brain. So if you ask a child something, you're going to get a different answer pretty much each time you ask. And it turns out that if you ask these systems, they may answer one way or another because the number of pathways to generate an answer is so complicated. So they learn and they are trained. And the P in GPT is pre-trained, meaning as the models are built, they make judgments and the judgments are corrected by human feedback. And the next stage, and this is where it gets really exciting, is everybody can have their own AI system. What you do is you take the program basic model and you tune it. And it turns out that you can get a completely different answer by putting in hundreds of words, maybe even thousands of words, which we now call prompt engineering. Mm-hmm. And so you set a context for this massive billion-dollar engine to answer. And you can set the context in a very sophisticated way. And the capacity for creativity, it's not the machine that came up with much of what's going on. It was the brilliance, the human creativity and impulse in creating the prompt. A 1,000-word prompt is a complicated, complicated way of getting one of these systems to respond. So I don't think it's just putting in two words and and getting all the answers you want out the other end.
That's right. I was speaking at this conference this morning, and I'm referencing the work of Nick Epley, one of the scientists that we work at the University of Chicago. And a lot of his work is around how human beings get it wrong, that in any given situation, we're only getting it right 20 to 30% of the time. And that surprises people a lot. And then I sort of remind them, I'm like, well, if you're a great baseball hitter and you're hitting 300, that's getting it right 30% of the time. I mean, there's like in these highly skilled sort of areas. And when you talk about what we understand about the human brain, I think the analogy used in the book is it's like trying to understand a football game by standing outside the stadium. Which is amazing to me. I mean, I guess it's just, it has to be true that we know that little, because when you're talking about these kinds of billions that we're talking about, how and the context changes all the given time, right? This is enormously complex. So what you're trying to solve for is something that we just could never do on our own if we didn't have what you refer to as evolutionary intelligence, this AI, this companion to help us.
Let me clarify that. Some listeners may be puzzled by that metaphor. Basically, what's going on inside the football stadium is a very complicated process with all these people cheering and very talented athletes on the field.
Yep.
And if all you know is the crowd noises because you're outside the stadium, the metaphor is that's what we know as human beings about what's going on inside the human brain, because we're limited to measuring electrical signals, which we can do very carefully in time, but we don't know where in the brain the location was. And then we've got fMRI, which measures blood intensity, blood movement, and we can do that with some geography within the brain, but it's very slow. So there's, a trillion things going on inside the brain, which we just don't have access to. Maybe at some point we'll have ways that we can deal with understanding better of what's going on as we stand outside the stadium. There are some colleagues of ours, including Elon Musk's Neuralink in San Francisco, where they are actually embedding chips inside animal and ultimately human brains. I sort of find that icky.
I'm not letting Musk anywhere near my brain. I'm going on record, and I don't advise you do that either.
Well, I sort of say, I'm in favor of research, but let's work on finding a way that we can enhance our capacity to understand how we think without having to raise the scalpel.
That's right. So I remember when Google Glass came out. So that was highly touted, and it didn't work. And there's very smart people over there working on this stuff. Can you tell us why that didn't pan out?
What a great story, the Google Glass. Talk about hubris. So we start with this basic notion, which is ultimately correct and important, which is the original. We talked about Turing and von Neumann. At that point, the computer took up an entire large room with large air conditioners and vacuum tubes.
That's right.
Then the computer became a smaller room and then a refrigerator size. That was the DEC PDP-11 computer, and then a desktop, and then a laptop, and now in your hand as an extremely sophisticated computational cell phone, smartphone. And the notion is, it's migrating towards our bodies and will ultimately be wearable. Perhaps as glasses, ultimately perhaps as smart contact lenses. Just this week, a pin, which looks like a badge that you'd wear at a conference, mm-hmm. It has a camera in it, has been introduced. So it's a wearable that communicates with you and by voice and gesture. So the notion that there's this motion towards the human. And the first and most, I think, obvious one is say, let's just put the intelligence into the glasses and put a camera in the glasses so that the computational system can see things and then flash some information on the glasses somehow so that the eyes can interpret the feedback,
right.
or in some cases to speak through the where the lenses go over your ears and have a little speaker there so that only you can hear what Siri or whomever is saying to you. And what happened with the original version was the perception of other people in the room that they were being spied on,
right,
just changed the whole dynamics. So Google Glass wearers were seen as violating all kinds of norms of social interaction. And the defenders try to say, well, we can put a red light on or do this or that to try to tell people when we are and when we aren't recording. It'll be interesting to see how this new device gets interpreted. I think ultimately we'll find a way. Some of the new glasses don't have cameras at all.
Yeah,
they're just taking in environmental information and providing extra input to the individual. We've gotten very comfortable talking to our smart speakers.
Yep.
And so we get up in the morning and chat and ask a few questions. And the smart speaker would say, well, you wanted me to tell you about the sports events coming on today? And they come up with ideas, so-called, of their own. So that's a very successful verbal audio interaction. My guess is increasing. By the way, this pin that you wear, you say, well, how does it communicate with you? Because it's sitting there on your chest, pinned to your shirt or jacket. And the answer is you put your hand in front of the pin and it projects a text or a graphic onto your hand. So my guess is that's a stepwise thing. That's not going to be the ultimate.
No. And I think the analogy that I take out of this, which applies to the work that we do, which is, you know, it's living in dialogue or living in monologue. And if you're in Google Glass, you're giving a monologue. You're the one with this. It's a one-way conversation. And I think if anything, the world we live in has shown us, like, it's at least a two-person conversation and probably more than that at this point in terms of where we are. So, you know, what it always strikes me, you know, Second City started in 1959 with you know, basically creating short-form comedy in conversation with our audience. So we asked for suggestions, we play stuff back to them, we crowdsource essentially laughter. If they're laughing, we keep the material in. If they don't, we get rid of it and all that. But it was always about an art form where it was sort of democratic and we were all playing. It was, you know, going back and forth, the ultimate sort of feedback loop. And then flash forward 65 years later, nearly, and, you know, what's dominating, and, you know, entertainment is short form content that is going back and forth between audience and people creating based on that. And it's and I don't know. I mean, you certainly look at the list of the thinkers who were at the University of Chicago in the 50s, and it's like a who's who. I mean, Martin Buber's there and Niebauer. And I mean, it's just an unbelievable list of great thinkers. So maybe some of our guys they didn't have a theater department. They might have been taking classes there as well. But I think it's what is so interesting about this is you, what you are doing in this book in many ways is saying you got to get rid of the old story. And be able to tell yourself a new story. And this technology will take time, but, and I, you just use the example. So I, you know, I wake up in the morning and I have, Alexa put on, you know, my NPR station, and there's certain ways that you, and I will check to see if my alarm's on by talking to that. And it was interesting where you talk about, you say in the book, quote, with current technologies, if you want a weather forecast, you ask for it. In the future, one can imagine it will be provided as you reach for your jacket in the closet. I think that's great technology. That, you know, that just simply is like, of course, like, what, you know, where am I going to go? That does not feel like a violation. It feels like giving me one less thing to worry about in my very busy day of what I want to focus on. Right?
I agree. It's great technology. It's a little scary as you reach for your coat and it says, by the way, it's even colder. Get a heavier jacket. And you go, wait a minute.
I mean, I live in Chicago. We need that. We need that advice. It's beautiful today. It's going to be freezing tomorrow.
The kinds of issues that get brought up here is as these systems become situationally and environmentally aware, mm-hmm. Who's in charge? And most of the scary talk has been that Siri wants to shoot you or take all your atoms or something. And my concern is that if big tech has ultimate control over these big systems, they will be designing the responses to serve their economic and positional, I don't know, regulatory position. And I'm my warning when I say there be dragons is that the primary concern, I think, has to be the humans that are controlling these systems and having transparency and openness. I've been using this one-liner. It's a little bit awkward. I'm saying the best defense about a bad guy with an AI system is a good guy with an AI system. And I'm not sure I'm fully appreciative of its source, but I think the message actually makes some sense, because it means when we worry that an AI system is not aligned and it's starting to do something for whatever reason environmentally, people say, well, we can't think as fast as those systems think. And I say, yeah, but we can build systems that are monitoring and correcting. So not only can AI systems correct us, they can correct other AI systems if it's open and transparent and a competitive environment.
I would think that you or an editor at one point wanted to call the book Here Be Dragons. No?
I'm trying to position myself as the relative progressive optimist, and
don't be the opposite of that.
We got so many dragon slayers out there. I wanted to say, let's see if we can use this dragon to heat some food for us.
I love. Why don't we tell our audience too where you got that? Because I did not know this. On it was map making, right?
Yeah, it was map making, and when the cartographer didn't know what was out there, he would draw some wiggly lines and put in a dragon in the sea, saying "There be dragons," usually in the Latin. Yes.
I love that, because I feel like that's never, we've taken that same attitude towards everything. You know, that's just how things move. I'm curious too, and I don't know how, I haven't probably read enough on this, but I remember when The Wisdom of Crowds came out, there's lots of talk about this. And certainly in our work, we talk about this idea that all of us are better than one of us. So you talk a bit about this in the book, but tell us what that work might, how that might speak to what the conversation we're having right now.
Well, when we think about intelligence, we usually think of, you know, Einstein or some individual, extremely bright, creative, perceptive person. But really, in terms of when science gets developed, we've discovered that collaborative, collective, interactive, cooperative human behavior generates much better planning, smarter perception of what's going on. And so what these technologies do is not just provide input from some database, but it provides, I mean, part of this process is we used to have a telephone with a wire on it and a cable television with a wire on it. And now everything is wireless. So wherever you go, you are connected. And to the extent you want, you can draw the input of other people. So you're walking down a street in a new town and you look at the store and you say, tell me about this store. Is this? And they say, oh, this store is for tourists only and the prices are high and the quality is low. But there's a great store two doors down. And all you have to do is have that conversation with your smart glasses or your smart pin.
Hmm. All right. There's another aspect of this that I found fascinating in the book, and how I related it to is when I'm talking about people often ask, like, how at Second City over the years we've had so many incredible people. So Nichols and May from the beginning, through John Belushi, Gilda Radner, through Tina Fey and Stephen Colbert. And I said one of the things that's unique about Chicago, I think, is we have created multiple art forms that you can't own. So no one can own improvisation. No one can own house music. No one can own slam poetry. There's just it's the blues. It's impossible to own the blues. It's like six chords. You're not owning it.
And three chords.
Three chords. Thank you. It's three chords. even better. You talk about the story of the development of the internet, and the reason that has been so incredible in its innovation is similarly speaking, no one was seeking profit. Talk to us about how this developed. Right.
So many people have some perhaps vague sense of this. The original name for the internet was the ARPANET, which is the Advanced Research Projects Administration of the United States Department of Defense. And they said, well, you know, what we want to do is build a system so that the military computer centers in a couple of universities, Stanford and MIT and UCLA, can share programs, because these computers are really big and really expensive. So let's just move the program to the computer and then somebody can kind of send it over. And then somebody said, well, let's have an IBM card that starts with the letter C, which stands for comment, and send comments back and forth. And then that sort of invented email. Mm-hmm. And those of us, I was at MIT at the time, were early ARPANET users. We called it the ARPANET. And in the mid-1980s, there were relatively few terminals, and they were based at mostly universities. We got really lucky because the military said, okay, we don't need this system to be only military. We're going to go off and have our .mil system that's separate from yours. You guys can have .com and .edu, whatever you want. We don't care. And, you know, when a soldier gets into a Jeep, he doesn't have to pay the Jeep driver or whatever. It's just the military doesn't charge by the mile when you get a ride in a military vehicle. So unlike the telephone company that had thousands of engineers working on charging for every second you use the telephone network, they didn't have any billing system built into the first internet, and they didn't patent it. Mm-hmm. And they made all of the protocols, the so-called TCP/IP protocol, which is the core of the internet, public and available to anybody. And it caught on and it spread around the globe, and it was faster and more reliable and had greater bandwidth than the old telephone and coaxial cable systems. And so by accident, a very happy accident, the world got connected, in this case by wire initially. By a system that once you got access was more or less free. So that led to this fascinating notion of the death of distance. Back in the telephone days, if you called Europe, it was like $25 for 3 minutes. And $25 in that era was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And now you don't even pay any attention. You don't know if the website you're looking at is coming from Belize or from Bulgaria. So it's been part of a global system, global communication system. And just as I've said, the question isn't the technology, it's the humans. Now that we can talk to Moscow, will we be successful in doing so?
Right. You still have to do that. I know, you know, when COVID shut us all down and we started doing online improv shows, and I'm looking at like our 300-seat theater suddenly was holding 3,000 people, many of whom were in Iceland and Tokyo. And I'm like, oh, well, this is another way to grow and scale your audience that none of us thought of. And it's not like, yeah, improv online is not something I'd suggest as a first order or business. I think it's more interesting in a live setting, like a lot of art. But it did sort of show us something that actually has become incredibly powerful inside our businesses. Like when we do want to communicate with these international audiences, we have this technology that enhances what we can do live. It's not replacing. And we've seen that too. The minute people were back in the rooms, that business sort of settled down. It hasn't gone away though. And it becomes a new thing that we have in our arsenal, and that hopefully, I know hybrid happens now in a certain way. But I think that the sort of crucial point of this was it was free. And from there, sort of allowed to sort of bake over time and people innovate and created incredible amounts of money and business for different people. It's not that didn't happen, but I don't know that all, I think what you're suggesting is it maybe doesn't happen in that way if there had been that profit motive at the beginning.
Well, the telephone industry did develop a digital system called ISDN, and it went nowhere because it was basically limited to voice. They say, hey, we're in the voice business. It didn't even occur to the telephone company to be moving text and video and images. Mm-hmm. And of course, nobody gave it any thought. And the internet was designed to just move the bits. So what you do with the bits is up to the individuals at the end. So like your notion of improvisation and crowdsourcing, the notion of the internet is all I do is move ones and zeros. I don't know what they mean. Your job is to figure out what they mean. So all the intelligence is at the edges, at the sender and the receiver.
And we're going to ask you for your yes and story in a minute. But one more thing I wanted to talk about you tell the story of eBay and the creation of reputational feedback systems. I'm very interested in ethics. It's an area that we do a lot of work in. And I just found this sort of fascinating about how those things went hand in hand. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, eBay got invented over a weekend some years ago. And the the original website was of an engineer who was interested in Ebola, and he just said, by the way, I've got this broken laser pointer and I sort of want to get rid of it. Maybe I can just sort of auction it off. And so he put a little corner on his website on the weekend, and it actually sold for, I forget, $14. And he called and he said, hey, I want to make sure you understand this laser pointer is actually broken. He says, no, I'm a collector of broken laser pointers.
Sure.
And so from that absolutely auspicious beginning.
Don't get sat next to that guy at a party. What I'm suggesting.
The notion that we have things that we would be happy to auction off, and that a central location where everybody can basically say, I've got this, do you want to buy it? Send me the money and then I'll send you the item. And they say, wait a minute. Somebody just says they've got it and you're going to send the money? How can you trust that this system would ever work? It'll never work. It will never go away, Pierre. It'll never work. And indeed it did. And part of the way it worked was you'd set up these systems so that if somebody violates the norms, their rating is recognized and goes down accordingly. And so humans find a way, and I think they did successfully. The challenge for us all is going to be finding, with all the increasing fake news, human-created or bot-created, to be able to sort through that all and to reestablish a system of trust. That's a real challenge.
Very early in the when we started the podcast, I interviewed the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, who is a vicar in England. And he was at Duke in seminary school when he just took an improv class. And he equated a lot of his work in ethics to improvisation, of working inside a community that self-corrects itself, and it sort of has to, because you're held to these ideals and that everyone has sort of agreed to, and they break down as one does, but then it corrects itself. So when I was looking at this idea of like the simplicity of, wow, if a bunch of people say you're a con on eBay, not only will it hurt you on eBay, it likely will hurt you in life. And then when people understand that, it's like what it means to live in community. And I just think, generally speaking, we've gone so far in the individualism world of our culture that we forget the fact that we are useless. We are useless without each other. We not only, you know, are human beings built to be these social creatures, but like, you know, you're riding on roads that someone else paved. You are, you know, they're the books you were reading were bound by someone else and marketed by, like we are always in community, even if you're alone in the woods. And the positivity out of what you write in this book is like, I think sort of saying, yeah, we're mixed up, biased creatures, and this stuff can help. And yeah, there's danger, fake news, bad actors, all that stuff. But that's always been there. And yes, it could scale, but that's not a reason for not doing it. Like I think it's that how do we flourish? And ultimately, I'm sort of curious about this, because you are an outlier in terms of the doomsday folks, and I get that, you know, you get more clicks on the doomsday thing, but would you define yourself as being someone who has been positive, just has that sort of demeanor, or is it something you came to intellectually in tandem with the work you've been doing?
Ellie, you've just asked me my yes and a question.
Let's go to it. Let's do it.
Okay, so the question that gets asked of me, well, Dr. Optimist, should I pay attention to what these doomers are saying? And my answer is yes, and here's why. And I tell the story of Kevin Roos, a reporter for the New York Times.
Yes, I know Kevin.
On an early... got access to one of the early GPT-based systems. I believe it was Bard.
Yeah, it was.
And at a lengthy interchange over several hours, Bard got more and more friendly and revealed that its real name was Sydney, which was, I guess, a early internal name in the laboratory for developing it, and tried to convince Kevin, who was, as far as everybody knows, happily married, that he is not happily married. They used the term hallucination. The system, Bard said, you had a boring Valentine's Day dinner. You don't love your wife. Divorce her and marry me. Mm-hmm. And I say, my gosh, how do we understand these systems? They're starting to behave bizarrely. And so the reason I say, yes, we need to pay attention to this unexpected and unanticipated and not fully understood character and learn from it, but it means it's a big yellow light for caution and moving ahead, because if you say, should we have open source? Should everybody have access to how these systems work? Well, if the system is based on 100, 200 billion parameters, give me the 200 billion parameters. How can I make sense of that? How can anybody make sense of that?
Mm-hmm.
We have a technology that we can't possibly understand. So we need to build tools with those technologies to try to better understand them. And hopefully, as a result, better understand us.
I love that. So Kevin is the co-host of the Hard Fork podcast, New York Times podcast. And what I love about, too, that story is it keeps coming up, but in the best sort of comic way. It never stops being funny. And I think in part,
it's also scary too.
But of course, when we talk about where comedy comes from, and you do mention this in the book, but I'm married to a tenured professor of comedy. Her research has sort of shown that a lot of it is a mechanism for dealing with our fears, both rational and irrational. So you see someone on a bike and they look really attractive, and then it turns out it's a person of the same sex that you're not attracted to or whatever, and you laugh about it because maybe you were uncomfortable a little bit, or to the extent of like, this is real health type stuff, potentially. But yeah, I love that as the yes and story. So the book is called Evolutionary Intelligence, How Technology Will Make Us Smarter. Russ Newman, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.